Welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost. Here with me today is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Coming up, if fraud is as old as the hills, why haven't we tackled it yet? And we look at the rise of the robo-advisor. But first, a bit of better news at last for savers. With a few eye-catching accounts appearing on the market, regular listeners will remember Simon's particular favourite from a couple of weeks ago, the Brexit bond, where you could get a bonus interest rate if you guess correctly whether the pound would rise or fall as Brexit happens. Well, now you can get a tasty rate if Man United do the double. Yes, indeed, Virgin Money are offering a 3% rate over 1 year, but only if the Red Devils win the Premier League and the FA Cup. Now, which of you is particularly excited about it? Oh, Lee, straight in there.
God, Georgie, this is like gimmick 101, isn't it, for a savings account?
Tell us more about it.
So Virgin did this last year. So Richard Branson signed a deal with Manchester United last year with Virgin Money. And they offered a Champions bond, so it was 1.25% over a year. If Man United won the Premiership, it doubled 2.5%. They finished sixth and about 24 points behind Chelsea, so it wasn't even close. So those savers, they put the money in that, didn't get a bonus, but also you sign up for like a Man United rewards system, so you get into the prize draw and that sort of thing. So it probably does appeal to Man United fans. I mean, I think there's probably a few Geordies that are a bit upset with Mr. Branson, actually, because Virgin Money used to sponsor Newcastle United. Their HQ's up there. I don't think they're probably too fond of the fact that they're offering these savings accounts for Man United fans.
Who's going to get that? Well, I suppose the Geordies would.
Which
absolutely.
It makes me think, I saw this as well about Kevin Keegan. I was just reminiscing when he said, oh, I love it. Absolutely love it. Anyway, I'll sorry, go off on a tangent there. But this new account, it's way worse than what they offered last year in the fact that it's very, 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 very unlikely that this is going to happen. It's a 1% rate, so it's lower than what they offered last year. That's guaranteed. You're going to get that regardless. Now, Man United have to win the Premiership and the FA Cup. They've got to do the domestic double to get it up to 3%. I mean, 3% is great. You can't get 3% anywhere at the moment. Even the NS&I bond was about 2.2%. over 3 years. So 3% over a year would be great.
Wouldn't you get better if you just went to the bookies? I'm not advocating gambling.
But that's a fair point. But you're going to lose that money, aren't you? But if you really do think that they're going to win a double, you are probably better just lobbing £20 on. The odds are actually not as high as what I thought they were. They were 20-1 when I looked on Paddy Power for domestic double. I thought that was, I wouldn't touch that with a barge pole, Geordie, to be honest with you. Or no, for Lukaku signs, you never know. But your open bond, you're going to get 1%. It's far lower than what you can get in over 1 year. But you might win a shirt or some tickets.
Well, firstly, you don't think they're going to do the double, right?
No.
Right, that's what we really care about.
No.
But secondly, just a bit of a gimmick.
Is it a bit cynical
in a way?
It's a bit of a gimmick, but I suppose at the end of the day, anything that encourages someone to save and they're going to be entered into this price draw, which will be a lure for people, you're guaranteed to get a 1%. All right, 1% is rubbish when you consider what else you can get on the market. But yeah, there's been a bit of a rise, I think, in these sort of gimmicky accounts. We were joking about the Brexit bond, but I mean, it's a bit of a sign of the times, isn't it? When instead of just offering good rates, we're kind of going down a bit of a gimmicky route. And to be honest with you, I mean, it just focuses on Man United fans, that, doesn't it? I mean, I can't imagine many non-Manchester United fans interested in getting a 1% rate.
Yeah, don't know what they think about Southend or Watford.
Look, if you do a Southend savings account, and I'd be interested, maybe.
For them not to win the double, you get some money. Brilliant. Yeah. Simon, you like this one?
I'd like to offer up my defence of the gimmicky savings account here, where we talk about the problem of incentives to save for people and how can people be incentivized to save when they get such low interest rates. And actually, maybe it's not the interest rate we need to worry about here. It's the kind of the idea that, ooh, I might get something right and I'll do well. People aren't actually thinking about the pitiful sum of money they'll get in interest. But it's like, ooh, I might win. I think I'm all for gimmicky savings accounts like the Brexit bond and the Manchester United account. The Halifax, did Halifax still do their Savers prize draw?
Yeah, that's been very popular, actually.
I like that one.
I'm with you on this one.
Hey,
Simon,
look,
I think
Britain
you're right.
Loves a gimmicky savings account. The premium bonds.
Yeah.
It's a savings lottery.
The Americans loved that when
Americans love it. Yeah. There was a whole there was a whole Reddit thread, which is like a website, a very popular website where things sort of go viral, and they'd linked to a story of ours on This Is Money when I'd interviewed Agent Million, who's the lady that goes around, and if you've won the premium bond, she knocks on your door and tells you, you know, here's £1 million, you've won them the premium bonds. Someone, there was a whole thread on the Reddit about how they couldn't believe premium bonds and why didn't they offer them in America. They were ingenious. So maybe, Georgie, we do love a gimmicky savings account, and maybe we're market leading in savings rates for savings products.
Excellent
globally.
Stuff.
We're the envy of the world.
Aren't we just? Okay, well, if Manchester United or Brexit pound gambling, not really your thing, but you still want a better return on your money, well, what about investing? Wouldn't know how or think you've not got enough money for it? Could robo-advisors be the solution for those of us who felt priced out of traditional investment advice, or who want to tap into new tech to invest? Now, despite a whole genre of dystopian Hollywood films and literature, perhaps the rise of the machines here is something we should welcome and not fear. HSBC and Investec are the latest providers to get involved. Investment expert and founder of the advice website Boring Money, Holly Mackay, is a fan.
They give an adrenaline shot in the arm to a stuffy industry. The websites are typically great to use. You can stay in touch. You can do stuff from a mobile. So if you're a sort of busy person on the move, then they're a great idea. They're also just, I think, for lots of people out there who get stuck by the tyranny of choice. You know, we're sitting there looking at lists, endless lists of 2,000 funds, thinking, where do I start? Which one do I pick? Robo-advisors do sort of take the choice away, but they take the hassle away too. When it comes to the downsides, things that make me wary, well, they're still new brands. They're not really tried and tested, a lot of them in growth phases. So I would always look at who the custodian bank is, the group that actually holds your money. So if something goes wrong, you know, are you likely to get that back? Who's actually holding the money? Many of the smaller robos have partnered with really big brand custodian banks, which gives me some degree of comfort. I've tested some of the robo-advisors. There's about 1.1 billion in them in the UK today. And by 5 years' time, I'm not going to hazard a guess now, but with groups like HSBC and Santander coming to the robo-advice party, you know, this is certainly going to go up and up in value and in growth.
So, Simon, this one is to you, if you don't mind. What do these services do? Who are they? Would we have heard of them? Robo-advisors?
No, a lot of these are new names. I mean, some of the old names are getting in on the act. We heard the HSBC there. Obviously, everybody knows who HSBC is. Mm. Investec's a well-known investment firm. And there are some well-known investment firms who are getting involved in this. It's a big growth area. But I think what we've established, see podcast past, is that people, when it comes to investing, have two issues. One, they can't be bothered. They just really don't want to deal with all the hassle. They don't see it as a hobby and something to get interested in. So lots of people do. An awful lot of our readers do.
A hobby, let's just break it down, Simon. Because a lot of people, when they invest, they'll just put some money, I don't know, with a Fidelity or Hargreaves Lansdown, and they'll do the business for them. You're talking about picking the individual
shares. I'm talking about people picking individual shares where you actually take enough of an interest in the company to justify buying those shares rather than having a rag bag of shareholdings that you've read because you read some tips somewhere. It is fairly easy to do, but you do need to do a bit of research. Mm. You could invest in funds. Again, if you're investing in individual active funds that invest in various places, you need to be thinking about what those funds do and how they work. Or you can invest in a global tracker fund, which just invests all around the world and is very, very easy. But there's lots of people who just, they don't want to think about this stuff. There's a classic drop-off point, if you talk to anybody who runs one of the investing platforms, where customers sign up to the platform and then they get to the point where they have to choose their investments and then they just drop out the process. And so they end up with an account with no money in it and nothing ever invested. And the other thing we've established is that people are worried about losing money. They're worried about gambling. They want the helping hand. Now, in the old days, the helping hand would have come in the form of the financial advisor or your friendly stockbroker, and they would have helped you choose what to buy. They would have been there with an arm around your shoulder when needed, an encouraging push up the hill, that kind of thing, helping you to buy and sell and telling you what looked good and what didn't look good. And for better or worse, they helped a lot of people invest for their future. There was an awful lot of mis-selling that went on, but there was an awful lot more people who did actually invest for their future. Now, that's become pretty expensive nowadays because they can't earn money from commission anymore. So there's a gap in the market for people who don't have lots of money and aren't being targeted by advisors. And into this gap, has Walk Technology and the world of the robo-advisor, where essentially it's an investment platform that helps choose investments for you. It builds you a portfolio, so you don't have to worry about that. All you have to do is commit to the idea of investing. You sign up. You generally tend to go through some form of risk profiling tool that assesses what kind of investor you might be. It will ask you various questions about your attitudes to loss, to risk, your time horizon, all those other things. And then it will deliver what it thinks is a suitable portfolio for you, based mainly on asset allocation, which is deciding how much shares, bonds, property you should hold and where in the world you should put it. And then all you have to do is pay your money in every month or pay in your lump sum. And it then looks after it for you, rebalances it. Some of them have a clever algorithm behind it. For example, there's one called Scalable Capital that's been set up by some ex-Goldman Sachs people who, you know, it's a clever trading thing to do with, you know, loss and everything like that. And then others have an investment committee. So a traditional bunch of people who make the decision and go, emerging markets look good. America looks expensive kind of thing. Let's allocate a bit more money there. But unlike the tendency of some private investors to go, emerging markets look good, America looks expensive, I'll put all my money in emerging markets, they tend to employ a little bit more expertise and they have a duty to do so. So they might just shift the portfolio slightly towards emerging markets. So it's like 10% less in the US, 10% more in emerging markets. It's cheap, it's easy, and there's a host of them. There's Nutmeg, there's the aforementioned Scalable Capital, there's Money Farm, other ones that employ a more simple approach where there's just a smaller selection of investments, like Moneybox, and that has a neat thing where you can round up your spending every month. So you spend £2.40 on a coffee, and basically at the end of the month it says to you, you spent £2.40 on a coffee, you spent 72p on a bag of crisps, you spent £3.80 in Pret. These are all your roundups. Do you want to invest them? And you hit the button and off it goes and invests it. You're not going to grow huge riches from that, but it all every little helps, as they say. And
it's
actually,
the mindset as well.
Actually, there's some research that's been done. We've spoken to the founders of Moneybox. There's some research that's been done, actually. I think it was done over in the States where they have this kind of, some companies got this roundup thing. And people who do it are more likely to invest more money. So it's not the roundups, it's they're actually more likely to engage with it and things like that. So that's that. But there's IG, another well-known name from the world, more of trading, but that's launched a smart portfolio system that helps you choose ETFs. So we had a look at these in a roundup. I recommend going and reading it. This is money.co.uk/DIY investing, and you can see the rundown. And if you're thinking of using one of these, what I'd say to people is go have a look, have a play around with a couple of them, decide on the one you like, and if you're a bit worried about it or nervous about it, just put a small amount of money in, see how it goes, and then you can move on. But there is something I wrote about the other week that I think there's a problem going on here, and I think that this is an issue for where the consumer, to the consumer's detriment, which is basically with an investing ISA, with the ISA system, you can only pay money into one new ISA every year. So basically, if you're the kind of person who already invests and has some shares that they hold, maybe some funds that they hold, but thinks, might like to try a bit of this new robo advice stuff, but I don't want to put all my money into that. I'll put, you know, half the money I invest every month into the stuff I'm already doing and half the money into this. You can't do that within an ISA, because if you've got half your money going into an ISA over here with your Hargreaves Lansdown account or whatever, you can't put the other half into a Money Farm or Nutmeg account or something like that. So I think that we need to do something about the ISA system, because you're starting to get different companies doing different things, and it means that you can't do it all under the ISA umbrella.
Lee, you love a good ISA. What's your views on this?
The whole investor thing, I think what's happening is there's a lot of younger people, you know, I hate the term millennials, but I'm going to say millennials, that are actually, what we were talking about with savings rates and how low savings rates are now tempted to sort of give these sort of investing platforms a go, and something like Nutmeg, because, you know, it's advertised heavily, especially sort of on the tubes and that sort of thing. And I think if you make it simple like that, where you can just be on a phone app and you can just round up something like a coffee and it just goes into a pot and you start to see it grow, and you probably do start to interact with it a little bit more. You probably do get a little bit excited when you see a little bit of growth, and, you know, obviously these things can go up and they can go down, but I think it's good. And as Simon says, I think it really is worth having a play around with some of these websites and see how you get on with them. And it is, I really do think it's a symptom of people just don't want to save. And lots of my friends, whenever they say, oh, I've got some money to save, where should I put it? And then I tell them what the rates are and how much they'd make on that. They'll just, you can just see them go, what?
Yeah.
So I'm going to make £1.80 every year. Right? You know,
what I wonder is, I mean, you see things like through cashback sites like Quidco, you can get yourself some money back if you do a stocks and shares ISA with some lender. And then you've got these things like Moneybox and you've got Nutmeg. I'm wondering if, like, 20 years time, a lot of people are going to have a lot of money just in these little
tech
companies that are, you know.
Quite possibly, Georgie. Well, in 20 years' time, when this podcast is still going,
absolutely, we'll discuss.
I'll set
it
a
then.
Reminder in my phone because I won't be changing phone anytime soon. In 20 years' time, I'll have the same phone, and I'll let you know.
Simon,
yeah, I think that you're probably right. There will be lots of people with bits of money dotted around the place, just hopefully slowly growing for them. But the advantage of one of these services actually is that, say, you did leave your 500 quid in one of these and forget about it, as long as it's still running. And it's still doing what it's meant to be doing, there'll be people there actually looking after your investments for you. So it's not like you just stuck 500 quid in this fund or this company 10 years ago and then completely forgotten about it, and then you look back at it and it's like, ooh, lottery ticket time. Did the company go bust or did the company do really well? Did this small cap mining fund that I invested in because I read an article about buying small cap mining funds, did small cap mining do terribly or did small cap mining do very well? You will actually have some people there whose job it is to be looking at your investments and managing them for you in the same way that it would if you had a wealth manager or a financial advisor. But a lot of this stuff, it's really worth just mentioning this point, is not actual financial advice in the traditional sense of fully regulated financial advice that we know. That's a complicated thing to go into, but it means that essentially you're protected if you get put into the wrong thing. Some of it is what's known as simplified financial advice, where it's only talking to you about one thing. Some of it's restricted financial advice, where it's not investing across the whole market, it just invests in a select number of products. Some of it is just guidance. And there are some services out there that are actually now doing financial advice, but using technology to do that. So there's one called Timber. That's not something where you're actually at the moment investing on a website. What you're actually doing is they're using the technology behind the scenes to make financial advice cheaper, easier, quicker. You can talk to them over Skype, you can talk to them over the phone, but they've streamlined the processes behind it so that everything can be done that bit easier. And they've got advisors in that, you know, their big thing has been finding advisors that they can trust, that you can trust. There's another one called eVesta, which is proper financial advice, and that's started up by someone who used to be involved with Money Supermarket, I think, and that's more of a mix with the online investing thing.
So there's still definitely a space for human beings in this.
There is. There's certainly a traditional advisor would tell you that the thing that they do that a computer program won't do is that their relationship with you is not purely transactional. Okay, so I think there's a big question at the moment about whether society has become very transactional. We've lost the relationship building element. We've lost the kind of the agency element where someone is acting for you, acting as your agent, rather than just, I'll sell you this or you buy this off me kind of thing. Mm-hmm. An advisor will tell you that they're there looking after you, watching your back, helping you along the way, coaching you, building a full financial plan and things like that. Whereas a pure robo-advisor won't be doing that. The problem the financial advice world has is it's all very well saying that, but lots of people don't trust financial advisors.
Well, exactly.
Because the financial advice world spent a couple of decades ripping people off.
No favours for themselves, have they, at all?
There's lots of great advisors out there, and they've kind of been tarnished by the bad behaviour of some of their industry.
Absolutely. Which, in completely unrelated news, fraudsters and scammers, Lee, if tricks are as old as the hills, why have we not got the better of them yet? This is what you've been addressing in this week's Big Money Questions with Ed Bullison, who is the Associate Professor of History at Duke University.
We're never going to get rid of fraud completely. The opportunities for misrepresentation in a capitalist society are always there because we depend on trust to grease the wheels of commerce. But there are definitely differences from one era to another, from one society to another, in terms of the incidence of deception in the marketplace and how we cope with it. In the last 40 or so years, at least in the United States, and I think there may be some evidence to suggest this is true in Europe as well, though I don't discuss that in the book, I think we've seen an explosion of large-scale fraud, scandals, episodes in which deceptions reach, in terms of their price tag, into the billions. and also frauds, misrepresentations that have been committed by some of the largest and ostensibly most reputable companies. That's different from what the case was, I would say, in the mid-20th century, where fraud certainly existed, but it didn't have the same scale, and it wasn't occurring at major investment banks or really significant commercial banks.
Now, he was telling your colleague Rachel all about the history of fraud, how it's changed, and where we're heading. And for the full interview, of course, go to thisismoney.co.uk. But in a nutshell, Lee, the scam man Boyce, what is he telling us?
Well, people still are falling victim to fraud and scams. And, you know, some of these things have been a common, you know, just derivatives of things from hundreds of years, you know, and there's always been con artists and con men. These days, a lot of it is being opened up by online and other methods of being able to sort of defraud people. So, I mean, for example, this week I've been contacted numerous times by people that have fallen victim to fraud. And we had a story last week or maybe the week before. There was a criminal psychologist who specialises in fraud and scams, and he fell victim. You know, he'd lost tens of thousands of pounds. So it's very easy to make, again, a sweeping viewpoint of saying, oh, I can't believe it, you know, how can you fall victim to fraud? How can you be so silly? But these criminals, Georgie, they know what they're doing. They know how to, you know, get you to hand over details that you think you would never do. You really don't think you'd ever do it. But fraud is a massive problem,
doesn't
it?
How is it changing? He does mention there that we're getting a lot bigger. The scale of some of these frauds are getting a lot
bigger.
Exactly.
Well, there's a lot of gangs that operate from various parts of the world. It's become very much a global thing. Mm. Rather than before, when you probably have to physically be in a country to defraud someone in that country, the internet, the dark web, all of this stuff has opened up the floodgates for fraud kind of globally. And the worry is, looking at it from a UK point of view, is that if you get defrauded and it's happened from abroad, so, you know, let's say it's come from Russia or it's come from the States, it's very hard for the police and authorities to sort of track down who's to blame. It's got to be a lot of cooperation between a lot of countries, and it starts to get quite difficult. And, you know, we're not going to start sending out teams to Russia and things to try and combat this fraud. It makes it very difficult, and it's opened it all up, and there's all sorts of tricks and things that people can do. And, you know, banks are trying to stay one step ahead of forces, but it's a difficult and expensive thing to do to try and stop this from happening and stop everyone from being defrauded.
Well, it is indeed, and it's interesting you mentioned the banks as well. I mean, I wonder if this is an anecdotal thing. You obviously are a lot more skilled and expert at this than I am, but it does seem to me, I'm reading, that banks are finding ever more ways to get out of helping you out if you are a victim of fraud. Is that fair to say?
I think it's very fair, Georgia, and I wouldn't be surprised if we start to get to the point now where more banks start to reject more fraud on the grounds of you should have known because these things have been around for a while.
You gave your password over.
You gave your password over and that sort of thing. And we've seen a couple of the big banks, you know, to basically not really, to me, not investigated enough on a case-by-case basis. I know sometimes I do agree with the bank, and I think, well, actually, you have been a bit silly there. And the bank can't, you know, it's there to make money at the end of the day. That, you know, that is what is, you know, it's a business. You know, they can't start handing back everyone's money all of the time because people do will just get lazy. They just go, well, there's a safety net there. That money's going to get paid back if I get defrauded. But it has to be done on a case-by-case basis. And I think a lot of it's people being tricked into handing over the money. They're not doing it intentionally. It's not like they want to be defrauded and lose this money. But, yeah, I really do think we're going to get to a point where banks probably do start, you know, putting up the drawbridge a little bit and saying, you know, we're not refunding on this and that. And I don't know, if that starts to happen more and more, I think we'll be hearing about it more and more from our readers that, you know, get in touch with us. We've led the way, I think, This Is Money, in our fraud coverage and scam coverage over the years. You know, every single scam case that we get in, we try to cover, you know, every type of scam. You know, it's an ever-evolving thing. But the reason why we do it is, you know, A, because we want to put pressure on the banks to hand back money when we feel as if they haven't investigated properly and haven't done what's been in the customer's best interest, but also to arm people with the knowledge. So if even just one person reads one of these fraud stories and goes, oh, I've read about, you know, I know not to do that because I read it. And, you know, you've just got to keep spreading the message, basically. The more we write about it, hopefully the more people read about it and the more unlikely they are to fall victim to fraud in the future.
being modest there, isn't he? Because he's been driving quite a lot of it, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. He's won tens of thousands of pounds back for people as well. That's a really important thing. But I think to tap into something Lee said there, I think maybe the banks don't do enough of that as well. I think one of the things that we often see with some kind of fraud is that one person gets defrauded in some way with one particular bank, and then lots of other people have been defrauded in the same way with that particular bank or institution. And we'll write a story, and then lots of people will come out of the woodwork saying, yeah, this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened to me. And invariably, they'll say that they have already spoken to the bank about it and that the bank's not been, you know, very helpful. So the bank itself knows it's being targeted, and it's being targeted by the same con being repeated again and again. But the bank isn't communicating enough with its customers to say, you need to watch out because, you know, Bank of Blogs is being targeted by con artists in this way because Bank of Blogs thinks that it reflects badly on them and that they don't really want to admit it. They don't really want to tell people. So instead of, you know, blazoning it out there, you know, they don't do it. And we've seen a change in the internet banking world, which we had a campaign about, Stop the Phone Bank Fraudsters, people phoning up, telling people to move money. And now your bank, most banks have a note on the online banking that says, if someone's called you up and asked you to move money to another account, don't do it. But you know what? It's pretty small, that note on your internet banking payments page. But really, I must admit, as someone who's worked in the media for a while, the way that you get people's attention is with a headline, and the headline needs to be bigger than the other stuff and snappier, and it's at the top as well. We don't put it at the bottom of the story, we put it at the top. So, I mean, just reflecting on the way that most people take in news in this world, they take it in with a headline, etc., you know, maybe they should be putting that in big letters at the top of the internet banking, not in small letters at the bottom.
Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce will be back next week, but in the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.